Let me welcome you to the Lakatos Award Lecture this year. The Lakatos Award is in memory and honor of Imre Lakatos, who came to the London School of Economics in the early 60s and who, with a cadre of other people, very small cadre, helped transform our image of what science is like. I think they received picture until then was of a body of theory. What fundamental science was like was, in the ideal, a static body of theory, a body of theory that matched what God had written in stone in the Book of Nature. And after Imre's work, we came to see science rather as a growing, progressing, dynamic process. So the lectures are in honor of Imre Lakatos, who's much remembered here at the LSE and elsewhere. The winner of this year's Lakatos Award is Professor James Woodward from California Institute of Technology. Now, here at the LSE, we've been very lucky over the last several years in that Professor Woodward has visited with us many times, and we've been able to engage with him, do research with him, benefit from his ideas, his work, and benefit from what, if it weren't thought to not even damn with faint praise, I would say benefited from his doggedness. Professor Woodward's winning book is about explanation, and there's a venerable connection between explanation and understanding, genuine understanding. And I think one of the very special characteristics of Professor Woodward's work is he's adamant about understanding. He's committed to securing understanding and ensuring to the best he possibly can that it's a genuine and not in any way a superficial understanding. And I should like to mention that this understanding is, I think, particularly the understanding that he's been looking for and achieving in his work, much of which is reported in the book, is very, very important here at the London School of Economics, because it's what he teaches, the understanding he provides for us about what causation is and how we learn about it is important, not just in philosophy, in fact, not even primarily in philosophy, but it's crucial. It matters across the social sciences. So it's a very great pleasure to have him here with us again. On the way over, an economist said to me that he thought that Professor Woodward was the greatest living philosopher. Now, I don't much go in for rankings, but I'm very happy with descriptions, and I should just like to close my introduction by pointing out that I think that Jim is not only among the most influential and most thorough, most careful philosophers working today, but he's also clearly among the handful of the most respected and most loved. It's very good to have you here, Jim. Thank you so much for your good book and your good help to us.
Thank you very, very much, Nancy. It is indeed a great pleasure and a great honor to be here tonight giving this address. What I want to talk about this afternoon is what I'm going to call a contrast between sensitive and insensitive causation. Basically, the contrast is this: sensitivity has to do with the extent to which a causal claim would continue to hold, would continue to be true as you change various other things. And I'm going to suggest to you that the issue of how sensitive a causal claim is an important dimension of causal assessment that has been relatively overlooked by philosophers, and I'll try to illustrate by means of examples why this dimension of assessment is so important. But first, some background. As probably some of you are aware, there's a long-standing philosophical tradition that connects causation and counterfactuals. What's a counterfactual? Well, a counterfactual is the claim to the effect that if some condition were met, something else would happen. where the condition in question, the first condition, is not necessarily one that's actual. So in other words, the counterfactuals encompasses claims about what would happen under purely hypothetical possibilities. So if you imagine a situation in which Susie stands before a glass bottle with a rock in her hand, she throws the rock hard at the bottle shatters, and then you ask what would have happened if Susie hadn't thrown the rock. If you claim that if Susie hadn't thrown the rock, the bottle would not have shattered, that's an example of a counterfactual claim. Now, in thinking about counterfactuals, it's useful to have some terminology in mind. The part of the counterfactual that is governed by the if clause, the Susie had not thrown the rock part of the counterfactual claim, is what I'll be calling the antecedent, and the rest of the counterfactual, the part that's governed by an explicit or implicit then clause, I'll call that the consequent of the counterfactual. Now, what I'm going to be talking about tonight is the contrast between two kinds of counterfactual information that can be associated with causal claims, or two ways in which counterfactual information can figure in causal claims. Now, one way in which counterfactuals figure in causal claims is probably very familiar and commonsensical to many of you. This has to do with the counterfactual dependence of the effect on the cause. So if you think about the example that I just gave in which Susie throws the rock and the bottle shatters, we think that whether or not the bottle shatters depends counterfactually on whether Susie throws the rock. She throws the rock, the bottle shatters. If she withholds throwing, the bottle doesn't shatter. So that's one kind of involvement of counterfactuals in causal claims. But there's another kind of involvement of counterfactuals in causal claims that I think has received less attention from philosophers, and this is really going to be my focus tonight. And this has to do with what I'm calling the sensitivity or stability of the counterfactual relationship connecting the occurrence of the cause and the occurrence of the effect. The stability of this connection under changes in various other factors. In other words, the question is the relationship of such a character that it would continue to hold as we change various other things? So to get back to the example of Susie and the rock, if Susie is wearing a white dress when she throws the rock and the bottle shatters, we think that if she were to throw under similar circumstances but wearing a red dress, the bottle still would have shattered. We think that if the temperature were a little bit hotter or a little bit cooler, it's probably true that the bottle still would have shattered. We think, however, that if the wind speed had been very, very great, maybe the same throw would not have shattered the bottle. Well, it's exactly those sorts of questions that are implicated in issues of sensitivity. To what extent, when we change these other things, the dress, the wind speed, etc., does the causal claim continue to hold? Now, just to be able to make things a little explicit and to make sure that we're all on the same page, I want to be a little bit more careful and explicit about what it is that I'm talking about. And so I'm going to follow a standard representation that the philosopher David Lewis, who is one of the main defenders of the idea that there's a close connection between causation and counterfactuals, has introduced. So let's let C and E be particular events, and let's let O of C represent the proposition that the event C occurs, O of E represent the proposition that the event E occurs, and let's represent counterfactuals by means of an arrow. So one up here tells you that if C occurs, then E will occur, or if C were to occur, then E would occur. And two, the dash is just my representation of a not, two says that if C does not occur, then E would not have occurred. And let's suppose that both of these counterfactuals are true and that we're looking at a case in which C does in fact cause E. Then the sensitivity of this claim that C causes E and the sensitivity of the counterfactuals associated with this claim is going to have to do with whether these counterfactuals would continue to hold under various other sorts of changes in the actual state of affairs, changes which are consistent with the occurrence of the antecedents of the counterfactuals. And to the extent this is so, that these counterfactual relationships are going to be, I'm going to describe them as insensitive causal relationships. And one of my themes tonight will be that, other things being equal, we value insensitivity in causal relationships. Insensitivity in causal relationships is a good thing. So in other words, to be even more explicit, we're going to consider counterfactuals of the form one star and two star that I have up here. And to introduce just a little bit more terminology, I'm going to call a counterfactual of the form one star, which relates the occurrence of a cause to the occurrence of an effect, an on-on counterfactual. We can ask whether that counterfactual is stable and or would continue to hold under various sorts of changes. And I'm going to call a counterfactual that relates the non-occurrence of the cause to the non-occurrence of the effect an off-off counterfactual. And again, we can ask about the stability of this counterfactual as we change various other things. Now, another of my themes tonight will be that there's an important asymmetry in assessing the sensitivity of a causal relationship like C caused E and the sensitivity of the counterfactuals associated with it. When we assess the sensitivity of this causal claim, we tend to focus mainly on the on-on counterfactual relating the occurrence of the cause to the occurrence of the effect. We place less attention and we focus less on the off-off counterfactual relating the non-occurrence of the cause to the non-occurrence of the effect in assessing the sensitivity, the overall sensitivity of the causal claim. And I'll give you some illustrations of this in a minute. And as I say, one of my suggestions will be that when a causal claim is judged by us sensitive, in the sense particularly that the on-on counterfactual associated with it is sensitive, we tend to regard the causal claim as problematic. But it's the on-on counterfactual rather than the off-off counterfactual that matters most in the assessment of sensitivity. Now, both of these sorts of counterfactual information that I've been talking about, the counterfactual dependence of the cause, the effect on the cause, and information about the sensitivity of the causal relationship itself are, I think, important to understanding causation, but they correspond to different strands or elements in that notion. Dependence information about the counterfactual dependence of the effect on the cause, has to do with the intuition that causes should be difference makers, that they should make a difference to their effect, at least when appropriate other factors are controlled for or held fixed. Information about sensitivity is connected to a somewhat different idea. It's the idea that causal relationships should exhibit some degree of generalizability or exportability or context independence. Now, in many paradigmatic cases of causation, such as the rock-throwing example, both of these elements, the counterfactual dependence of the cause on the effect and the sensitivity of the overall relationship of counterfactual dependence between effect and cause, are present together. So in Susie's case, we have both the dependence of the bottle shattering on whether or not she throws, and we also have the idea that that causal relationship would continue to hold if various other things in the background were changed. But there are other cases in which these two elements, dependence and insensitivity, can come apart or dissociate or vary somewhat independently of one another. And I'll be giving you illustrations in a minute. Now, causal overdetermination in cases of causal preemption, these are things that have been much discussed recently in the philosophical literature, are cases in which counterfactual dependence fails to be present, at least in its simplest or most obvious form, but in which there's a substantial degree of insensitivity. Causal preemption is an example of this would be something like the following. Susie throws, the impact of her rock causes the bottle to shatter, but if she hadn't thrown, there would be a Confederate waiting in the wing who would have thrown his own rock and caused the bottle to shatter. In this case, the simplest form of counterfactual dependence of the effect on the cause doesn't hold, although you can maybe, if you control for the right other factors, make the counterfactual dependence reappear. These examples, as I say, have received a lot of attention in the philosophical literature, but examples with the opposite profile That is, cases in which counterfactual dependence is present, but in which this relationship of dependence is itself relatively sensitive, have received considerably less attention. But I think they're equally interesting and important. It's this that I'm going to be focusing on. Now, one of my claims, which I've already foreshadowed, is that many people think there's something odd or non-standard or non-paradigmatic about examples in which you have counterfactual dependence of a sensitive sort. And this general reaction that there's something funny about these cases encompasses a range of more specific possibilities. Some people may think that when you have counterfactual dependence of a highly sensitive sort, it isn't real causation at all, and they'll draw from this the conclusion that counterfactual dependence is not, as is commonly thought, sufficient for causation. Others may think that in cases, at least some cases of this sort, and I'll be giving you examples in a minute, so others will think that in some cases of this sort, the relationships are genuinely causal, but there's something misleading, perhaps pragmatically misleading, about the assertion of these causal claims. Still, others may think that the causal claims in the examples are genuinely true, but the causal relationships are in some way shallow or defective or unilluminating or unhelpful from the point of view of explanation. Now, I'm not going to say that any one of these particular responses is correct. It's not important for the purpose of this talk to suggest, to choose among these different responses. What I want to suggest is simply the idea that there's something odd about causal relationships that are highly sensitive. And I think when you consider some of the examples I'll be presenting to you, you'll, I hope, agree with me about that. Now, again, just by way of stage setting, I need to introduce a further distinction between types and tokens. Philosophers distinguish between type causal claims and token causal claims. A token causal claim is a claim that relates to individual particular events as cause and effect. So if I say that Susie's throwing of the rock on this particular occasion caused the bottle to shatter, that's a token causal claim. If instead I make a causal claim that relates types of events, so that I say that one type of event causes another, that's what philosophers call a type causal claim. So if I make the general claim that impacts of rocks cause bottles to shatter, that would be an example of a type causal claim. Now, so far I've been talking about the sensitivity of token causal relationships, but one can also ask equally well about the sensitivity of type causal relationships and about the sensitivity of the counterfactuals associated with them. So for example, here's a biological example. Consider the generalization alleles, that is variants of a gene of type G cause phenotypic traits P. And we can associate this with this causal claim, a bunch of counterfactuals of the sort that I've described here. If alleles of type G were to be present in organisms of type O, then O will have phenotypic trait P. And we can ask whether such counterfactuals would continue to hold under various sorts of changes in the organism and in the environment surrounding the organism, which are consistent with the occurrence of those genetic features. And in fact, if you look at what molecular biologists and molecular geneticists currently focus on, one of the issues that they're very interested in is the issue of the so-called modularity of genetic regulatory networks. Basically, what this means is whether a network is such that it would continue to have the same effect, the same phenotypic effects, if there are changes elsewhere in the genome. Well, in asking this question, you're in effect asking a question about sensitivity. And this is one illustration of how the notion of sensitivity can come in an important way, considerations of sensitivity can come in an important way in a biological context. Now, I've been talking so far about the extent to which a counterfactual claim or a causal claim would continue to hold if we were to change various things in the background, if we were to introduce various sorts of departures from actuality. But what sorts of changes or departures from actuality matter for the assessment of sensitivity. Well, I think in biological contexts and in ordinary common sense contexts and in the social sciences too, we're particularly interested in changes that don't depart too much from the actual state of affairs and that don't seem too far-fetched. And this idea of not departing too much, very vague, from the actual state of affairs encompasses, it seems to me, a number of different possibilities. One possibility is that we have a background theory that, in effect, describes for us a range of possible alternatives to the actual state of affairs, and we have associated with this range of possible alternatives some natural metric or measure over it that allows us to talk about how much or how little a departure from the actual state of affairs has occurred. So imagine the following example. You have a driver proceeding along an icy road. He comes upon a patch of ice, loses control of the car. The car begins to skid. The driver struggles with the car, regains control of it, and he ends up on the shoulder of the road rather in the ditch beyond it. Now, if the driver was at this time driving at 55 miles an hour, counterfactual state of affairs in which he's driving at 57 or at 53 represents a relatively small departure from actuality. One in which he's driving at 90 miles an hour or at 20 miles an hour represents a correspondingly larger departure from actuality. And again, in assessing the sensitivity of the claim that if the driver had been driving in under the conditions in which he drove, but at a different speed, he would have ended up, say, on the shoulder. We think of those departures that vary the speed only a little bit as small departures, those departures that vary the speed a whole lot as large departures. In other cases, though, the relevant considerations that seem to bear on judgments of whether we have a large or a small departure from the actual state of affairs for the purposes of assessing sensitivity seem multifaceted and very difficult to make precise. So, for example, if in the actual situation Susie's rock travels via an unimpeded path toward the bottle, striking and breaking it, an alternative in which there's a solid steel barrier interposed between the path of the rock and the shattering of the bottle strike us intuitively as a very large departure from actuality. A variation in which the momentum of the rock has changed only slightly strike us intuitively as only a small departure from actuality. But formulating a set of general rules to make these sorts of, that would allow one to make these sort of assessments precise and algorithmic seems to me to be a very difficult, if not impossible, task. Now, another point that's important in connection with assessments of sensitivity is this, and it's the following consideration, that the changes that are important may very well depend very much on subject matter or disciplinary specific considerations. So consider the example of economics. Economists, other things being equal, are particularly interested in such questions as whether the generalizations they've formulated will remain stable or will continue to hold under changes in the economic incentives that economic agents face or under changes in the information that's available to them. Sensitivity under these sorts of changes is regarded as problematic for an economics generalization. An economics generalization that's sensitive under these sorts of changes, other things being equal, is probably going to be regarded as less than fundamental. There are other sorts of changes, however, that are of considerably less interest to most economists. So, for example, suppose it's true that by giving some drug to everyone in the population, you could turn them all into altruists. And suppose it was true that under this condition, various generalizations of microeconomics would fail. This is regarded as not a very interesting kind of change or departure from actuality from the point of view of doing economics. So again, the general point is that which kinds of departures from actuality matter for the assessment of sensitivity may very well depend on subject matter specific considerations. Now, one way, or another example in which you have this sort of dependence of assessments of sensitivity on subject matter specific considerations comes from genetics. Suppose that you have a generalization that relates some phenotypic trait to its supposed genetic causes, and suppose that this generalization is highly sensitive to changes that occur elsewhere, including in particular changes that occur within the environment, and including specifically changes in social practices. In this sort of case, we'll often regard the causal claim that the phenotypic trait is caused by some genetic structure as potentially misleading. In other words, sensitivity under environmental changes, particularly those involving changes in social practices, is regarded as particularly important and also sort of particularly damaging in connection with the assessment of causal claims about genetic causes. Okay. Now on to some more specific examples. First of all, David Lewis, I've taken this terminology of sensitive and insensitive causation from Lewis, and here's the way Lewis draws the contrast between insensitive and sensitive causation. He says, when an effect depends counterfactually on a cause, in general, it will depend on much else as well. If the cause had occurred but other circumstances had been different, the effect would not have occurred. To the extent this is so, the dependence is sensitive. And here's Lewis's example. He imagines that he writes a strong letter of recommendation for someone. This causes this person, let's call this person X, to get a job that he otherwise would not have gotten. And as a consequence of this, some people exist and eventually die who would not otherwise have existed. Why does this happen? Well, the supposition is that X, as a result of Lewis's letter, gets a job at University A that he otherwise would not have gotten in the absence of the letter. At University A, he meets someone who he wouldn't otherwise have met. They marry and have children who wouldn't previously have existed, et cetera, et cetera. So the existence of those children and their children's children, et cetera, and their eventual deaths is counterfactually dependent on Lewis's writing the letter of recommendation. And in fact, since Lewis thinks that counterfactual dependence by itself is sufficient for causation, he thinks his letter of recommendation caused the deaths of all those children, something that I think strikes most of us as a somewhat odd or at least non-typical or non-standard thing to say. So Lewis describes the letter of recommendation example as sensitive causation because, as he puts it, there are many differences that would have deflected the chain of events. And he contrasts this with a case in which you shoot your victim point blank, let's suppose through the heart, with a large caliber gun. And he says in this sort of case, only some very remarkable circumstances would have prevented the victim's death. So the second case, you have a case of insensitive causation. You can imagine something that might happen that would have prevented the victim from dying. Maybe there's a state-of-the-art heart surgeon waiting next immediately beside the guy. Maybe he's ready to substitute an artificial heart as soon as the shooting occurs, et cetera, et cetera. But obviously, these would be very far-fetched and unusual circumstances. In most ordinary circumstances in which you're shot in this way, you die. So this is an example of relatively insensitive causation. So just to be a little bit more explicit about this, the counterfactual dependence of the death of this some particular person, P, on Lewis's writing the letter, L, is going to consist in the holding of these two counterfactuals here, which I've labeled 1 and 2. And the counterfactual 1, as we've seen, is very sensitive. Why is it very sensitive? Well, even if in the actual circumstances Lewis writes the letter and some person P is born who otherwise wouldn't exist, and this person then grows up and eventually dies, there are nonetheless many other changes that would have disrupted this counterfactual one. So if Mr. X meets his spouse in a certain bar next to University A at say 12 o'clock in the evening, and if he'd only left the bar a little bit earlier, he never would have met this woman, then person P would not have existed. So one, even if true in the actual circumstances, is going to be very sensitive. By contrast, two, that is, if Lewis had not written the letter L, P would not have died, is not very sensitive, because in most scenarios in which Lewis doesn't write the letter, person P never comes to exist. And this illustrates the asymmetry that I was talking about earlier. It's really the sensitivity of the on-on counterfactual relating the occurrence of the cause to the occurrence of the effect that leads us to judge the overall causal claim as a sensitive causal claim. The sensitivity of the off-off counterfactual, in this case counterfactual 2, counts for less. So one of the points that's illustrated by the letter of recommendation example is simply this point about the asymmetry that I just mentioned. But there are two other points that are also worth emphasizing. The first is simply that you can have a relationship of counterfactual dependence between events. And notice that the counterfactual dependence here is, to use the philosophical jargon, of a non-backtracking sort. It's of a sort that's appropriate for capturing causal claims. But the relationship itself can be relatively sensitive. That's what you get in the letter of recommendation example. So whether or not a relationship is one of counterfactual dependence, whether or not it's sensitive, these are distinct questions or distinct dimensions of assessment. And then the second point that I want to make is that examples involving relatively sensitive counterfactual dependence strike many of us as in some ways problematic or non-standard. I take it that was the reaction of many of you to the letter of recommendation example. People may disagree about exactly how the example is non-standard or problematic. Some people may say it's just literally false that writing the letter caused many people's death. Some people may think, well, it's literally true, but it's misleading. But in any event, there's something funny or non-paradigmatic about these examples. Now, I now want to take this idea about the importance of sensitivity in assessing causal claims and use it to explore, first of all, an issue that's figured importantly in recent discussions of causal claims in ordinary language, the question of whether omissions or absences can be causes. And then I'm going to use the same apparatus to talk about some issues involving causal assessment that arise in connection with some biological examples. So a standard question in the philosophical literature, and it's actually of interest in legal context as well, is whether omissions or absences or failures for something to occur can count as causes. And we seem pulled in two directions on this question. On the one hand, there seem to be cases in which it seems very, very natural to regard an omission or a failure to act as itself a cause. So imagine a case in which a gardener is charged with the responsibility of watering some plants. The gardener is the only person with this responsibility. The gardener neglects to do this. As a result, the plants die. It seems natural in this sort of case to think of the gardener's failure to act as causing the deaths of the plants. So this seems to be a case in which we feel very comfortable with the idea that an omission can be a cause. On the other hand, there are other cases in which this seems, the claim that an omission can or an absence can be a cause strikes us as sort of problematic or at least a very odd or puzzling thing to say. So consider the claim that my writing of this very paper or my giving this very talk was caused by not being hit by a large meteor. It's certainly true that there's counterfactual dependence in this case, right? If I had been hit by the meteor, I would not be giving this very talk. Given in the actual circumstances, I've not been hit by the meteor. I am, in fact, giving the talk. But nonetheless, this seems an odd thing to say that my giving the talk is caused by my not being struck by the meteor. And one can readily come up with many other examples. So sometimes we seem to judge omissions as bona fide causes, and sometimes we seem to judge they're not. And the question then is, what's the difference? Well, the suggestion that I want to make is that other things being equal, the cases in which we're reluctant to say that an omission is a cause are exactly the cases in which the relation between the omission and its putative effect is relatively sensitive. And by contrast, the emissions that we're more inclined to accept as causes involve less sensitive relationships. I don't claim this is the only thing that goes into the assessment of the causal role of emissions, but I think it's one important consideration. So consider, again, the meteor example and the two counterfactual claims that are associated with it. Claim one, if I had not been struck by a large meteor, I would have written this paper. Even if this is, let's suppose, true in this situation, it's relatively sensitive. Why is it sensitive? Well, because my writing this very paper, my giving this very talk, depends upon many other things, despite, in addition to the fact that I haven't been struck by a large meteor. For example, it depends on what sorts of conversations I've had. If, no doubt, if I had talked more to Nancy and John, I would not be giving, for example, this very talk, but a better one. I would not be giving this very talk if I had not been given this award, et cetera, et cetera. So my giving the talk depends upon much else besides my being struck by a large meteor. Change those background circumstances, and one turns out to be false. On the other hand, two is relatively insensitive, right? In almost all situations in which I'm struck by a large meteor, and most kind of nearby variants of that situation, I die, and hence I don't end up writing this very paper. Well, again, my claim is that it's the sensitivity of one that plays a role in generating whatever reluctance we have to accept the claim that my failure to be struck by the meteor caused my writing of the paper. So again, this is an illustration of the asymmetry that I was talking about earlier. Again, it's the on counterfactual relating the occurrence of the cause to the occurrence of the effect that seems to matter most in assessments of sensitivity. Now, we can bring this out in a little bit more detail in the following way. Let's reverse the facts of the situation. Suppose that I am struck by a meteor and die, never writing this paper, never giving this talk. And now consider the causal claim that being struck by the meteor caused me not to write the paper. Now, our focus shifts to the counterfactual two, that is the counterfactual here. If I had been struck by a large meteor, I would not have written the paper, because that's the counterfactual that relates the occurrence of the cause to the occurrence of the effect. And as we've seen, this is a very insensitive counterfactual. And because this is a very insensitive counterfactual, the causal claim that my being struck by the meteor caused me not to write the paper strikes us as entirely unproblematic. Okay, so that's what I have to say about the causal role of emissions, and I now want to turn to some biological examples, which I'm going to claim illustrate something like the same principle about the importance of sensitivity at work. So here's an example drawn from Christopher Jenks. Jenks is a sociologist, but he's also very interested in issues having to do with genetic causation. And he gives us the following example. He asks us to suppose that external sexual characteristics are genetically caused. And it seems to me that the notion of genetic causation ever makes any sense at all. This claim is surely going to be true. Now, in our society and many other societies, social expectations and customs based on such external sexual characteristics lead women to have on hair, have on average different hair length, indeed typically, though not always, longer hair than men. So one might represent this in the following way. This was actually supposed to be an arrow here. So when you see those little boxes, just think arrow. We have hair length L counterfactually depending on social expectations E, which in turn counterfactually depend on sexual characteristics S, which in turn counterfactually depends on genotype G, whereas I say the arrow from X to Y means that Y is counterfactually dependent on X. Notice again that the counterfactuals here are all sort of non-backtracking counterfactuals of the sort that's appropriate for many philosophers would claim for understanding or explicating causal concepts. But should we think of these relationships of counterfactual dependence that I've just been describing as establishing that genotype causes hair length, or that there are genes for hair length? Well, again, I take it that genotype causes hair length strikes many people as, if not literally false, at least misleading or problematic in some way. And of course, this is exactly the reaction that Jenks wants us to have. He wants us to think more deeply about what genetic causation actually involves by thinking about examples of the sort that I just described. Now, Jenks's own discussion occurs in a context of the assessment of the causal significance of coefficients of heritability. I want to take his example and make a somewhat different point that's related to considerations of sensitivity. What I want to do is to trace the problematic character of the claim that genotype causes hair length to the fact that this is a relatively sensitive or unstable causal generalization. And in particular, it's unstable under changes that are regarded by us as particularly important, as I mentioned earlier, in connection with claims of genetic causation. That is, changes in social conventions or expectations. So if, for example, societal expectations were to change so that women were expected to wear short hair, or both sexes were expected to shave their heads, of course the counterfactual dependence between gender and long hair would completely disappear. So more generally, what I want to suggest is that the claim that an outcome is genetically caused, even if arguably literally true in the sense that the outcome is counterfactually dependent on genetic features, strikes us as problematic when the counterfactual dependence itself is highly sensitive to changes in the environment. Okay, so that's one point that I want to make about the importance of sensitivity in biological context. Here's a closely related point having to do with the role of interaction in the assessment of causal importance in biological contexts. So it's frequently been observed that most or all phenotypic traits are the result of an interaction between the organism and genotype and its environment. And what interaction here means is simply the following, that for every genotype, there are at least some environments in which the genotype produces different effects. And for every environment, there are at least some genotypes for which in the presence of that environment and those genotypes should get different effects. So people who point to this fact about interaction, and Susan Oyama is one of the most prominent people who've done this, draw from this the moral that it makes no sense to claim that either of these causal factors, either the genotype or the environment, is in any way more important or privileged in the production of phenotypic traits. Instead, the conclusion we're supposed to draw, according to Oyama, is that both of them are equally important, both of them play a symmetrical role. But notice that this point about the interaction between genotype and environment in producing phenotypic traits is perfectly consistent with an asymmetry of sensitivity in the relationships between, on the one hand, the genotype and the phenotypic outcome, and on the other hand, the environment and phenotypic outcome. And those differences in sensitivity, I suggest, are closely connected to the judgments we're willing to make about whether it's the genotype or the environment that's more important in producing the phenotypic trait. So take a look at the following chart here. I also had, I believe, copies of this distributed, just so you can refer back to it. In this chart, you're to imagine that the G1, G2, G3, G4 on the left-hand column here are alternative alleles or alternative variants of the genotype. E1 through E4 are alternative possible environments, and the chart tells you what the phenotypic outcome is for each combination of genotype and environment. So you have genotype G1 and environment E1, then you get the phenotype P1. If you have genotype E2 and environment, genotype G4 and environment E2, then you get phenotypic outcome P4, and so on and so forth. Now notice that in this example, for each genotype and environmental type, there's an interaction in the sense that each genotype produces at least two different phenotypes in different environments, and each environment produces at least two different phenotypes in the presence of different genotypes. Nonetheless, if we treat each of these genotypes and each of these types of environment as equally important for the purposes of assessing sensitivity, you'll also see that in the example, there are asymmetries in how sensitive the genotype-phenotype or the environment-phenotype relationships are. So, for example, if you look back at the chart, you'll see that G1 produces P1 in most of the environments, that is E1, E2, and E3, in which it occurs. So in this sense, the relationship between G1 and P1 is relatively insensitive to changes in environment. By contrast, G2 produces P1 only in the environment E1 and not in any other environment. So in this sense, the relationship between G2 and P1 is relatively sensitive. And as you can see from the chart, a similar sort of asymmetry in sensitivity is present with respect to some of the genotype, some of the environment phenotype relations as well. So I want to make two suggestions about the significance of these asymmetries. I think that part, not the only part, but an important part of what people who use notions like innate or genetically specified sometimes mean is that there's a relatively insensitive relationship running from some feature of the genotype to some phenotypic trait of interest. In other words, the relationship is such that it's stable across many different environments. And when that's true, I think we tend to think of the trait in question as, in some sense, relatively innate or relatively genetically specified. There are, of course, many, many different things that one might mean by innate or genetically specified. This is merely one possible thing that one might have in mind, but it's interesting because it connects up with exactly the same aspect that I was talking about earlier, that you see present in the letter of recommendation example and so on, considerations of relative sensitivity. So, by contrast, if as is the case with the G3 and with G3 and G4 in the table above, the same allele produces different phenotypical traits in all or almost all different environments, we're going to be more inclined to think of that trait as acquired rather than innate. So that my suggestion is that the claim that hair length is innate or is genetically specified or genetically caused in Jenks's example strikes us as misguided, at least in part because that relationship of counterfactual dependence is so unstable or sensitive. By contrast, if you think of the relationship between, say, eye color or external sex characteristics and genotype, these strike us as much more plausible candidates for traits that are genetically specified or innate, exactly because the relationship between those between genotype and those phenotypic traits is relatively insensitive to environmental changes. For most changes in environment, given that you have a certain genotype, you're not going to get variations in eye color, for example. And so that's a suggestion about how sensitivity connects up with judgments of innateness in biological context. Here to return to the idea or the theme of causal importance, what do such claims mean? Well, one thing they may mean, and I take it to be illustrated by the chart I put up there, is that such claims can be associated with asymmetries in sensitivity. So if, for example, one causal factor, A1, will produce an outcome, E1, as long as some other factor is in any one of a large range of different states, but for each one of these alternative states, BI, the outcome that results is highly sensitive to whether alternative variants A1 through AN are present, then other things being equal, we're going to regard A1 as a more important cause of E than any of the Bs. So the idea is that to the extent that the relationship between C and E is stable or insensitive under other sorts of changes, we're relatively more inclined to regard that as a more important cause. To the extent that that relationship is highly sensitive, we're more inclined to think of the factor in question as of less causal importance. Now, I should pause here to acknowledge that there are, of course, all sorts of things one might mean by causal importance. There are other kinds of things that one might mean that aren't captured by this sort of account at all, but I think it does capture one important element or strand in our judgments of causal importance. And I think it particularly captures something that's important in a lot of biological contexts. So let me conclude with a final illustration, again drawn from a biological context. Consider the debate between those who emphasize the role of natural selection in the evolution of various kinds of character traits and those who instead emphasize the importance of so-called developmental constraints in the evolution of these character traits. I have in mind here people like Stephen Jay Gould. There's, of course, a long-standing and difficult-to-resolve argument that goes on between these two groups of people, with the adaptationists claiming that natural selection is the more important factor in shaping the traits of the various animals that we see around us, and those like Gould who emphasize developmental constraints instead say, no, these are the more important factors. And one of the things that has been so obscure in this debate is just what's meant by talking about causal importance in this context. I mean, after all, presumably none of the people who participate in the discussion deny that natural selection has some role in the traits that evolve, and presumably no one denies that developmental constraints play some role either. So what exactly is the argument about? Well, one way of trying to get a handle on what the argument is about is to see the different participants in the argument as implicitly committed to different claims about what sorts of relationships you would expect to be sensitive and which sorts of relationships you would expect to be insensitive. So suppose you think that it's natural selection that plays the most important role, or at least an important role, in the evolution of some trait T. What are you going to suppose then? Well, you're going to think that there are environmental conditions, E, posing some adaptive problem, such that natural selection is going to produce a trait like T in a large range of cases in which E is present. In other words, over a very wide range of different genotypes, phenotypic histories, variations produced by drift, noise, et cetera, as long as you have the same environmental challenge, you're going to get the same trait evolving. So in other words, you're assuming that the relationship between the environmental problem that's posed and the trait is relatively insensitive across changes in other things, like changes in genotype, phylogenetic history, et cetera. And it seems to me this is, in effect, what strong adaptationists are assuming. If, on the other hand, you think that developmental constraints played an important role in the species' possession of the trait, natural selection a less important role, the expectation about what's going to be sensitive will be quite different. The expectation is now going to be that if we take this species and other species that are genetically related and we vary the environmental conditions in which they live in such a way that alternatives to trait T would be more adaptably advantageous under those conditions, one would see relatively little variation in T. In other words, the idea is that the relationship between T and certain features of the genotype, presumably features of the genotype that have to do with fundamental regulatory circuits, so-called bowel plan or whatever, these are going to be relatively insensitive to changes in selective regime and other sorts of variation. So contrary to what the adaptationist supposes, the power of natural selection to change the relationship between the genotype and outcome is going to be relatively limited. So in this case, too, I think you can trace what's going on, or you can frame the debate, or you can see it as a disagreement about which relationships you should expect to be sensitive and which relationships you should expect to be insensitive. So in conclusion, I'd just like to say, and this is really the basic take-home message of this talk, that considerations of sensitivity and insensitivity are, I think, extremely important in the assessment of causal claims, both in science and ordinary life. And this is a dimension of assessment that's been relatively neglected by philosophers, and I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done on it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. We have about half an hour for discussion, questions, remarks. I'm looking for the microphone. Here in the front row, please.
I notice that you've made no reference to the possibility of divine intervention. For example, suppose we look at the case where you say a letter was written which caused someone to go to a situation where he met somebody else and so on. How do we know that the person who wrote the letter wasn't inspired by God to do so? Now, that may sound ridiculous, but I believe there are an awful lot of people who do ask God to intervene at times in their lives, whether they've got a difficult choice to make, or whether they're in a situation of despair, or someone is dying, or whatever it might be. I personally believe that a number of significant events that have been very powerful in shaping my own life can only be explained by divine intervention. Now, are you in a position to say that's all nonsense?
Certainly my talk doesn't go to the question at all of whether there's such a thing as divine intervention. I was assuming a certain factual background about what sorts of interventions will change things and what sorts of interventions won't. And I was, staying entirely within the natural world and making no claims one way or another about what would happen under various sorts of supernatural possibilities.
Alex?
But I mean, if in fact God does intervene, then most of what you've said this evening would be pointless and irrelevant.
Sorry, most of it is what?
If God does intervene in our lives, in our decision making, in the events that affect us, then most of the things that you've said this evening really would be irrelevant.
I don't actually see that, because I think that even if God does intervene fairly frequently in the world, surely there's such a thing as natural science. One can still ask whether relationships between features of the genotype and phenotypic outcomes are stable or not under various kinds of changes. So it seems to me that sort of inquiry can still go on regardless of what your religious commitments are.
Alex, two rows back.
Yeah, I was wondering about what makes what determines sensitivity. And as you went through your examples, the first criterion that came to mind was a pragmatic one. So do we call a certain causal relationship sensitive or insensitive? Depends a lot on the purpose we have in mind when we want to intervene, using the causal relationship, the world as we, as observers, find it. So it seems very much, at least at first look at it, would seem very much related to our interests, our abilities to intervene, which determine whether a certain causal relationship is sensitive or insensitive. Just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think if you follow up this line of thought, you're led to exactly that conclusion, that which relationships we judge as sensitive, and it partly depends on our purposes. It partly depends upon facts about how we, so to speak, chunk the world. Assessments of sensitivity typically only make sense, or they make best sense, in context in which we're chunking the world in a fairly coarse-grained sort of way, so to speak. From the fine-grained perspective of fundamental physics, I'm not sure that the kinds of considerations that I'm talking about really play any role at all. But I think when you get to the social sciences, when you get to biology, when you get to common sense causal thinking, they're really quite crucial.
Yes, please.
Sorry, I was wondering, how do you relate your sensitivity and insensitivity relations with probabilistic causality?
Okay, well, that's a very interesting question. How do I relate considerations of sensitivity to results having to do with probabilistic causation. Well, you can certainly see in some of the current theories of probabilistic causation an appeal to what I would call considerations of sensitivity. So, for example, as you may be aware, in some theories of probabilistic causation, the requirement is a so-called unanimity requirement is imposed, according to which the cause has to raise the probability of the effect across all possible background circumstances. Okay, well, that's in effect a very strong claim to the effect that you expect the probability raising capacity of the cause to be extremely insensitive across all sorts of other changes. Okay, you can imagine a more relaxed standard in which the cause raises the probability of the effect across certain kinds of background circumstances and not others. And my own attitude toward this is to be relatively relaxed and contextual about it. And so the unanimity requirement strikes me as a bit too strong, a desirable thing to have when you can get it, but perhaps you can't always get it. So I think when you look around, all sorts of things seem as though they all sorts of features of extant theories of causation seem as though they implicate considerations of sensitivity in one form or another.
Okay, we have a question here, and then in the front row.
Yeah, I was just wondering. Do you think there are independent ways of assessing sensitivity? I mean, independent ways of assessing departures. What ways that are independent of causal considerations? Otherwise, it seems like there's a bit of circularity in terms of.
Sorry, could you speak up, David?
Yes, sorry. Are there independent ways of assessing departures in terms of how, you know, whether something's sensitive or insensitive? Otherwise, it seems like the departure, i.e. how fast you need to go to cause an accident or whatever, it seems like you've already bringing in the causal factors.
Mm-hmm.
Can you independently assess?
And by independently, you mean can you specify this in a non-causal way?
Yeah, exactly, is that? Yeah.
That's an interesting question, and I don't know in general what the answer to it is. It actually strikes me as an empirical question that might very well be explored by psychologists. That is, one could actually, give people a range of different examples, and see whether it's true that variations in what I've sort of intuitively called the sensitivity of the causal claim really does correlate with people's willingness to accept the causal judgment or people's judgments about the strength or efficacy of the cause. And then you could just see what sorts of considerations, what sorts of variations move people's judgments around and which don't. But I think in a lot of these cases, the judgments of sensitivity will themselves have a sort of already a kind of causal aspect to them.
Front row, please.
Yes, on the matter of whether something as small as a letter can lead to people dying, don't we already have a clear mathematical basis for formulating this question in terms of nonlinear dynamics, where a very small input into a rather simple system can have large effects on the system, such as the question, does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil cause tornadoes in Texas?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think if you sort of specify the causal claim at sort of that level of coarseness, that is, that the claim of interest is something like the flapping of the butterfly's wings caused the tornado. Suppose for the sake of argument that that turns out to be true, surely that is going to be a very highly sensitive causal claim. Yeah, so I think that chaotic systems, you know, systems that have a nonlinear dynamics, at least when described in a highly coarse-grained way, will exhibit exactly the feature that I've been calling insensitivity.
Can I take that?
Excuse me, sensitivity.
I'm sorry. I was going to mention that there are a number of people whose core work, number of people in the audience whose core work is on causation. I think they're holding back so as not to get the discussion too technical, and I'd like to urge you not to do so. Good, Damien. But before that, can I ask a question?
Of
which
course.
Is, since there hadn't been any hands up at the time I started, I wonder whether you've got a view about what's going on in the background. Is there really such a thing as the causal relation? Because you talk about what we would say, and not about, as in earlier works, you sometimes talk about if and only if, you know, C causes E if and only if. You talk about what we would say, and I'm particularly concerned because, I think it's a particularly interesting issue for you now, because you think the counterfactual account isn't enough, and then what you're adding on in this discussion to the counterfactual account are claims about what people would say. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether or not that means that there's just the counterfactual facts, and then on top of that, depending on sensitivity, we say it's causal or not, or whether you think there actually is something, the truth of the matter, about causality that counterfactual account is simply a kind of token, a symptom of, or do you see the problem? And what I'm worried about is what you actually think about causation, and whether these are just interesting kind of things we say, or is there something more than counterfactuality there in the world, or is that not an interesting question to you?
It's certainly an interesting question, and I guess the way that I'd be inclined to think about it is the following. I think that the what's real, or if I can put it this way, or what's out there in the world, are they're facts about patterns of counterfactual dependence, and they're also facts about the sensitivity of those patterns. Okay, and that is sort of what's real, so I think if you have that sort of picture, I framed things in terms of whether we would readily accept a causal claim like the letter of recommendation that caused many deaths, partly, I guess, just for expository reasons, because it seemed like an easy thing to generate the problem. But I don't mean to merely be making a claim about what people would say. I think that in the letter of recommendation example, there are sort of real features of the situation, as it were. They're facts about how the world is that are reflected in the judgments of sensitivity that we make.
Well, so we can take it, let's take it as given, for the sake of argument, that there are facts about counterfactuals and there are facts about sensitivity. Is there anything more than that when we are using the concept of causation? And in particular, I'm thinking about this question here, where there was a suggestion that perhaps you can't, as in your own account of intervention, that perhaps you can't characterize your notion of sensitivity without using causal notions, in which case it seems like maybe there's more on your very own account to the world than the facts about counterfacts and the facts about sensitivity.
Well, if there are such further facts, I guess I don't have a very clear sense of what they might be. Let me just put it that way. I think that this is now going to, I guess, be a little bit technical. But I think one thing one might consider trying to do would be to try to sort of bring together the kind of account that I've been offering and a more causal process oriented account. Basically by thinking of the causal processes as it were, carriers of particularly insensitive kinds of causation, if I can put it that way. So that when you have, it may be that it's exactly when you have relationships of counterfactual dependence that are relatively insensitive, you also have something like energy momentum transmission via a spatially temporally continuous process or something like that. And that perhaps would be a way of sort of bringing together these two approaches. So I'm certainly not hostile to the idea that after you've said the things about sensitivity and counterfactual dependence that I've been talking about, maybe there's something more to be said of a sort of more ontological or worldly sort about what causation is. I think that would be that's a fruitful further question to ask. I would insist, though, that particularly in connection with the scientific examples that I talk about, I think that regardless of where one comes down on these more ontological questions, there's real methodological significance to considerations of sensitivity for the reasons that I've tried to illustrate. It actually matters which sorts of relationships you think are sensitive and which aren't. And I think a number of causal disputes in areas like biology and psychology are exactly about that issue, even though the participants in the dispute often don't entirely understand that.
My question, I think, was partly preempted by Nancy. My question was going to be, is sensitivity supposed to be a property of these counterfactual claims or a property of the causal claims? Because you seem to be switching between the two in your descriptions. I mean, your title, you had sensitive and insensitive causation, and then you started talking about sensitivity of counterfactual dependencies. And I think maybe you've already addressed that with Nancy's point.
Well, just to be explicit about that, the way that I tried to do it in the talk was to first associate counterfactual claim. I begin with the causal claim. I associate counterfactual claims with it. And then I ask about the sensitivity of the counterfactuals under various sorts of changes. Remember that I said that one can take a causal claim and you can associate with it these two counterfactuals, the on-on one relating the occurrence of the cause to the occurrence of the effect, and the off-off one relating the non-occurrence of the cause to the non-occurrence of the effect. And I said then it was the on-on counterfactual and the sensitivity of that counterfactual that was actually the more important in judging the overall sensitivity of the causal claim. So the strategy I was following was to look at the counterfactuals associated with the causal claim, assess them for sensitivity, and then use that supposedly to explain our judgments about the original causal claim.
Just to follow up very quickly, I mean, you just finished by saying that the sensitivity of the counterfactual claim somehow tells us something about our judgment of the causal claim. And I'm just wondering, it seems to me there's still a bit of ambiguity in terms of what the nature of that judgment of the causal claim is. Is it something like it's no longer a causal claim, or it's a causal claim that's not useful or not useful in certain situations and so on? So I guess you went too fast for me in the talk, but I'm trying to pin you down a bit more.
Well, if you may remember, that was I raised that very issue and then refused to come down on one side or the other about it. What I wanted to say, or what I did say, was that our reaction to these claims that are highly sensitive is that there's something odd, non-paradigmatic, non-standard about them. But exactly how to further explicate that, I was non-committal. I think my own experience or my own sense is that different people have, you know, say different things or reach different kinds of conclusions on this very issue. So that some people will say in the letter of recommendation example, no, it's not causal at all. Others will say, well, it's causal, but it's highly misleading or a very funny thing to say or something like that. And for the purposes of my talk, I didn't feel as though I really needed to take a firm stand on that issue.
Yeah. Your response to one of the previous questions, you said that what you said about sensitivity and causality mainly applies to social sciences and to kind of everyday reasoning, but wouldn't apply to fundamental physics. This seems to be exactly right. There are clear cases in physics that are highly sensitive. For instance, you need very specific initial conditions to produce a universe in which the second law of thermodynamics holds true.
Right.
So I wonder whether you could say a bit more, why is this? I mean, why is causation at the macro level kind of sensitive to sensitivity, while causation at the fundamental level, so to speak, does not seem to have this sensitivity? So where does that come in and where does it fall out?
Well, I think that's a very difficult and profound question. One reason why I think we care about sensitivity at the macro level, I think, does go back to the fact that we're human agents who are interested in intervening and controlling things. And the macro level, the relationships that are most useful from the point of view of manipulation and control are the ones that are relatively insensitive. Okay. So if suppose, for example, that I have a choice. for some reason, all of the examples in this literature are involve murders and deaths and maimings and so on. But so here's an example. I have a choice between two kinds of poison. One will be entirely deadly, but only under extremely specialized conditions. So if you're in exactly the right physiological state, and I give you the poison, you die, but otherwise you're unharmed, okay? And so that's poison one. Poison two is, and that would be a relative, poison one is a relatively sensitive poison. Poison two is will produce death in, say, 80% of the cases in which it's administered, but it's effective across a very wide range of physiological conditions, background conditions, et cetera, et cetera. If I'm interested in manipulation and control, and I don't know exactly what the condition of the world is or what the condition of my prospective victim is, then I might be much better advised to use the second rather than the first. So I guess part of my answer to your question is that it's just that as macroscopic agents, and given that we have the interest that we do in manipulating and controlling the world, sensitivity stands out as, considerations of sensitivity stand out as particularly important to us. But then I think that this very fact ends up sort of informing our causal and explanatory judgments, and in fact informing our science, insofar as the science is at the level of biology or social science. And it may be in some way that at the, in fundamental physical context, the macroscopic agent sort of doesn't come into the picture in the same way for a variety of different reasons. Either because things are too big or because they're too small, perhaps for other reasons as well, and that plays some role in our tendency to think about causation in physics in a quite different way, if indeed it is true that we think about it in a different way, and I'm not entirely sure about that either.
Michael.
Thank you. I've got a rather... microphone's on. Rather simple question that goes back to the that goes back to your two kinds of counterfactuals that you differentiate. That there were the on counterfactual and the off counterfactual, mm-hmm. And you said that somehow the sensitivity of the on counterfactual is more crucial to our causal judgment than the sensitivity of or insensitivity of the other one. And I wanted to ask you what is if there is one, the philosophical motivation for that, because, well, if we look a little bit back, then this is somehow deviating from the classical, idea of all the counterfactual accounts of causation that we know, because, well, the first counterfactual that you mentioned is no true counterfactual at the end, because it's a true conditional where the antecedent is fulfilled. So it's the occurrence of a certain event that brings about, say, is conditionally dependent, or on which the occurrence of another dependent is another event is conditionally dependent. And the usual idea of counterfactual accounts was more expressed by the second type of cause,
right.
The off one. So you're now going for a more kind of production aspect of, you know, the occurrence of one event more producing the other type of event. And I was wondering what the deeper motivation behind that was. Second question would maybe be...
let's let him answer that one first.
Okay, well, I didn't catch everything that you said, but let me try to respond to that. So why do I think it is that it's the first counterfactual, the on one, that's so important in assessments of sensitivity? Well, I think there are a couple of ways of motivating this idea. One way is to just observe that, at least in a token context, the first counterfactual, the on counterfactual, is entirely trivial if you would adopt a Stalnaker-Lewis semantics for counterfactuals. So within this semantics, as long as both C and E occur, it's automatically true that if C occurs, then the counterfactual, if C were the case, then E would be the case, is automatically true. So that leaves, as you say, all of the work in the standard counterfactual account to be done by the second counterfactual, the off-off counterfactual. So part of what I'm doing, here's one way of thinking about it, is providing a framework in which the first counterfactual, the on-on one, can do non-trivial work as well. Okay, so when you ask about the sensitivity of the on-on counterfactual, you can, even though it's trivially true in the actual circumstances, as long as C and E occur, it can nonetheless turn out to be highly sensitive, okay, or it can turn out to be highly insensitive. So there's a something, there's work for that first counterfactual to do on an account like mine, where it doesn't, it's really just an idle element in account of causation like Lewis's. Now, another point that's related to this, you suggested, and I think you're absolutely right about this, that one way of thinking about this first counterfactual is that you can think of it as an attempt to capture the productive aspect of causation. And this goes back to the distinction that I made earlier about the two kinds of elements or strands in our notion of causation, to which counterfactual dependence on the one hand and sensitivity on the other hand correspond. When you ask whether a relationship is sensitive or not, and you're looking particularly at the on-on counterfactual, what you're really asking is something like this: does that cause have the, you know, to use Nancy's language, the capacity to produce that effect in a range of different circumstances? And that's really the force of that. That's really what you're asking when you ask whether that relationship is sensitive or insensitive. And that, I think, gets to the, I think it, intuitively, that somehow gets to the productive aspect of causation. You know, is there some oomph there, if you like, that will produce the same result in a range of different circumstances? Or is the dependence that you're seeing in some way, I don't hesitate to say an artifact, but so highly sensitive to the particular setup that you're in that if you change anything even a little bit, you won't get the dependence anymore. I think that's our intuition, it seems to me, about the letter of recommendation example, right? In the particular context that Lewis imagines, and given how everything else happened to play out, it is true that the whether this person lives or dies, whether this person dies or is never born, depends upon whether the letter of recommendation is written or not, right? But we certainly don't think if you were to take a letter of recommendation and, as it were, move it around to different contexts, it would systematically cause the death or existence or non-existence of particular people in that way. So, and that's, I think, what the first on-on counterfactual and its assessments of its sensitivity is getting at.
Michael, I'm afraid we've now got a long queue suddenly. So is it okay? Maybe
sure.
Your second question was even more interesting than the first, but Hasek.
It was a very good question.
Yeah. Is this on?
Yes.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there are at least some odd cases in which insensitivity and causal importance are quite decoupled.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, if somebody would make a causal claim that somebody being born causes them to die eventually,
right,
that would seem to be almost completely insensitive, but at least in the common intuition, that seems like an irrelevant thing to cite as a cause. So, and there would be opposite cases as well, like if I claim that my parents having slept together caused me to be born. If that claim is about me as a very particular person, then that's an insensitive, that's a rather sensitive claim,
right,
because all sorts of things could have happened,
mm-hmm,
to cause someone else to be born.
Right.
But in that case, we would strongly feel that there's a very important causal factor that I'm citing. So, in a way, this is a version of Roman's question, except with stupid examples. What is the behind this linkage that you see in a lot of cases, as you convincingly argue, between insensitivity and causal importance? What's the
Well, I don't really know that I have anything to add besides what I just said. I think it's tied to, first of all, let me say about your examples, I completely agree, and that's why I was careful to say that I thought that considerations of insensitivity captured one element or strand in our judgments of causal importance, but I think that there are lots of other considerations that affect judgments of causal importance as well. And my what I had to say certainly doesn't capture all of them. To go back, though, to the question, the more fundamental question is, you know, why, I mean, basically what you're asking, I guess, is why do our causal judgments exhibit this sort of feature, right? What's the underlying reason or rationale? Well, I can appeal to the sorts of things that I said in response to Roman's question. Here's another thing that perhaps might help a little bit. There's many people have the intuition that causes have to necessitate their effects, okay? And of course, the problem has always been to explain what necessitation might mean in some way that is, you know, not completely circular and unilluminating. Well, here's one thought. Necessitation just corresponds to a very insensitive causal relationship. In other words, given the presence of the cause, the effect almost always happens regardless of what else happens. And that's something I think that, I mean that surely at that point aren't we getting kind of close to one of the things that we think one of the features that we think a paradigmatic cause should have? You know, so you think of the, you know, why do you think of the shot through the heart as necessitating death? Well, because given the shot through the heart, regardless of what else might have happened, death almost surely would have been the result, okay? We don't think of Lewis's writing the letter of recommendation as necessitating the death of somebody who lives 100 years in the future, exactly because there are so many other things such that had they been different, that outcome would not have ensued.
Jim, do you think that the fact that it's now 7 o'clock, which necessitates us coming to a close, and that's very stable across a lot of variation, do you think that it's being 7 o'clock is going to cause us to close? Anyway, I'm afraid I have to apologize. There are at least four people who have wanted to join the discussion and indicated their willingness to do so, but it is 7 o'clock and we do have to close. And I'd like to invite you all to the drinks and award ceremony upstairs on the fifth floor and the senior dining room, or is it the room? The senior common room. So we'll see you all upstairs, and could we thank our speaker again and all the people who participate in the conversation.
Thanks very much to all of you.